Blog Talk Radio.
Dying, life, bright the hawk's flight on the empty sky. From the creation of Ea. Greetings and welcome, all you beautiful listeners, to Zarayana Radio. This is your host and humble storyteller, Evan Poss. On another beautiful summer morning. And I'm here with producer and engineer, Daniel Michael. How you doing, Daniel?
I am well. How are you? And I just wanted to make a brief note that we have a live caller that even has the I want to be in the host queue button. So we have somebody calling in that wants to be in. But I say go through your little introduction first, and we'll go ahead and get the live caller on.
Fantastic. Our first caller. How exciting. Thank you very much. We'll be with you. And we are also joined today with Kevin Baird, co-host with Daniel Michael of the Main Street Universe show.
Another day in paradise.
Excellent. So this is very exciting. We've got a guest with us. Both the hosts of the Main Street Universe, and we have a live caller. I'm going to start off handing the floor over to Dan, and he's going to fill you in on everything you need to know about what's new on the Main Street Universe Network.
Okay, hello everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and in some places it would actually be evening. I'd like to start off with announcing our new news for the Main Street Universe Network, which is now a network. So our network now includes Zarayana Radio, which you're listening to now, our flagship show, Main Street Universe, Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, daytime, as well as Kevin Baird's show, Walking on the Sidewalk, A Horizon Oracle Journey, which is now from 5 to 6, right?
Seven.
6 to 7. You're making a one-hour show from 6 to 7. We'll send a couple of quick plugs out there. Don't forget to find Kevin Baird at www.templeofgaia.com. He's as well a member of a group called Artisans United. He's the creator of Paranormal Windows and of the Horizon Oracle deck, as well as Gaia Gardens as part of his artwork. With the group Artisans United, there's as well our friend Dr. Zohara Hieronymus. You can find her at www.zoharaonline.com. She's written a book called Sanctuary for the Divine Presence. So feel free to visit www.zoharaonline.com. She's a friend of the show, and our ratings did jump up dramatically after she was our guest, and she was kind enough to put us on her website, which is always nice when one of our guests does that. And Lily at Esoterica, it's an online store right now, still with your New Age interfaith focus, herbs, crystals, stones, oils, candles, incense, divination tools, and more. It's www.esotericanova.com. And she's a friend of ours that we want to promote and hope to see her get that brick-and-mortar store again up and running. But right now it is only online. I guess I don't want to say only. The show, in fact, is online. And that's not just an only. And Kevin will be appearing at the Weems Bot Museum today. And Kevin and I did a little bit of paranormal investigating at the Weems Bot Museum. And I was looking for the video you and I did. Is that on the Weems Bot site, or was that... Okay.
Yes, the video that we did where we talked to one of the spirits in the Victorian room is on video, and that we communicated with them by using the K2 device, a little flickering kind of device that lets us know when energy is in there. It's up on the Weems Bot Paranormal channel.
Okay.
So that way we're putting all their activity right there, so that way it's all in one spot, basically.
All right, and I'd also like to make the announcement, and I see we have a caller, and we'll get to you in just a minute, caller. Like to make the announcement that we have a new co-host coming to Main Street Universe. He was our guest a couple weeks back, and that'll be Mr. Nick Berry. He will be the new addition for a while, for however long it lasts, to the Main Street Universe team. Every Wednesday he'll be here in person. He won't be calling in. So that should be fun. He's a interesting guy. He's a language, English language major in college, and loves history and is fairly well read and has an interesting occult history of his own. Nowadays he calls himself a very liberal Catholic, but it should be fun. So we will be welcoming Nick Berry starting this Wednesday to the Main Street Universe family here. And now we'll get on to our host at Zorian Radio, Mr. Irvin Pass.
Thank you, Dan. We got lots of interesting stuff going on here at the Main Street Universe Network. I also like to mention a couple things that are going on right now for all of our local Virginia area DC listeners. One is that the Smithsonian Folklife Festival is still going on right now. I believe it goes until July 8th, so another 3 days. If you get a chance, we will definitely check that out. It's very interesting. And one last thing is Amma, who they call the Hugging Saint, is going to be coming to D.C. Tomorrow, July 6th, and also July 7th. So if you're in the area, be sure to check that out. Now, we do have a caller, and this is very exciting. I've noticed we've got a 707 area code, which really makes me excited, because that means it is someone from back in Northern California. So, hello, are you there?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Evan, guess who?
All right, guessing game.
Who is it? It's Matt Levin.
Yes,
religious
Matthew.
Studies graduate of 2010, or 11.
Dude, Matthew, I'm so glad you're listening. Gave a call.
It's my first time listening right now. My first time I'm on a mobile phone down here in Los Angeles, got my earbuds in, and the only way I can listen is through the telephone.
Yeah, I understand that's one of the ways that we can, I mean, you know, don't have too many options with this type of radio. We've got the telephone listening and the internet.
Yeah, so
I'm glad you called. How are you
doing? Good. I'm doing very well. I have a question for you guys. Is Facebook the only, I mean, what's the regular internet means to listen to this show if I'm on a mobile device? Is there any option besides using my minutes?
Yes, there is. We have on the website, so this is through Blog Talk Radio. And just because it's really like the only means I have of getting this out to, you know, my friends and the people I know, I've been posting this on my Facebook, but it's not actually through Facebook. It's I've been posting a link, and on the website there, it takes you to the Blog Talk Radio website, and then from there, it's on the Main Street Universe Network. So,
right. I got that. I don't know what it is with my iPhone. I don't think I can listen to Blog Talk Radio on the phone. But have you guys checked out SoundCloud?
I'm definitely familiar with SoundCloud, but I wasn't certain that we could.
I don't think you can live stream. I don't think you can live stream, but I would highly recommend uploading previous shows with SoundCloud, just so you have an archive available to listeners.
All right, that's a good idea. Kevin Baird's telling me that you can listen to them as MP3s.
Okay.
On iTunes.
Oh, you guys have it iTunes. Okay, cool. Nice. Well, anyway, it's my first time listening, so I'm in. Let it go.
Awesome. Thanks, Matt. Really appreciate
all right.
it. So yeah,
you.
For all right, take care.
So you guys are in Virginia, huh?
Yep, living in Virginia right now. Moved out here at the beginning of the year.
Very nice.
Yeah, might as well say. Matthew Levon and I are both graduates from the Humboldt State Religious Studies program the same year, and took a lot of classes together. Had a lot of really good times. Went to some on amazing spiritual retreats at different places, you know, through the program, and took some awesome classes, got to listen to some great teachings.
Yes.
And, you know, and that's, you know, kind of what this show is about for me, is just like continuing that process now that I'm out of the academic system for, you know, for a little while. You know, I kind of want a medium to keep this going. You know,
yeah.
Channel what I've learned, and you know how it is.
Yeah, I've been exploring Freemasonry, and
really
I joined my local lodge and have become an entered apprentice by this point. My grandfather was a Mason, so I decided to be good, follow those footsteps. So yeah, that's a great topic.
Awesome.
Anyways, let's get to some content.
All right, and we do have some really good content. Are you going to stay on the line, or are you going to...
I want to listen, so I'll be on the phone line, but I'm at the gym, so I'm working out right now.
Okay, awesome. So, okay, we'll put you on mute, and you can continue listening.
Okay.
Matthew, thanks again for calling. Call in anytime, especially if you got some... stories or a piece of mythology or some, from some lore from the Freemasonry. Give us a call while we're on there. Be great to share it. All right. And now for what we're getting into today, I've got two wonderful stories for you by two of my favorite American mythmakers, both of whom are... science fantasy writers, I suppose, by, you know, just what the content of their work is. But in a lot of ways, I feel like these are both writers who, storytellers first, great writers. And, science fantasy is the medium through which they convey that. So we have first a story, which is actually a chapter of her book, by Ursula K. Le Guin. And I'll be reading the first chapter from A Wizard of Earthsea. And that was actually the little piece of poetry that I read in the beginning of this show. This is from the beginning of A Wizard of Earthsea, which is actually the first of six books in the Earthsea series. And following that, I have a wonderful story by the illustrious Gene Wolfe from his collection Endangered Species, a story called Thag. And without any more filler or such things, let's get right into it. Warriors in the Mist. The island of Gaunt, a single mountain that lifts its peak a mile above the storm-racked Northeast Sea, is a land famous for wizards. From the towns in its high valleys and the ports on its dark, narrow bays, many a Gauntishman has gone forth to serve the lords of the archipelago in their cities as wizard or mage, or looking for adventure, to wander working magic from isle to isle of all Earthsea. Of these, some say the greatest, and surely the greatest voyager, was the man called Sparrowhawk, who in his day became both dragon lord and archmage. His life is told in the Deed of Ged and in many songs, but this is a tale of the time before his fame, before the songs were made. He was born in a lonely village called Ten Alders, high on the mountain at the head of the northward vale. Below the village, the pastures and plowlands of the vale slope downward, level below level, and other towns lie on the bend of the river are. Above the village, only forest rises, ridge behind ridge, to the stone and snow of the heights. The name he bore as a child, Dunny, was given him by his mother, and that and his life were all she could give him, for she died before he was a year old. His father, the bronzesmith of the village, was a grim, unspeaking man, and since Dunny's six brothers were older than he by many years, and went one by one from home, farm the lands or sail the sea, or work as a smith in other towns of the northward vale, there was no one to bring the child up in tenderness. He grew wild, a thriving weed, a tall, quick boy, loud and proud and full of temper. With a few other children in the village, he herded goats on the steep meadows above the river springs. And when he was strong enough to push and pull the long bellows sleeves, his father made him work as a smith's boy, at a high cost in blows and whippings. There was not much work to be got out of Dunny. He was always off and away, roaming deep in the forest, swimming in the pools of the River Ar, that, like old Gauntish rivers, run very quick and cold, or climbing by cliff and scrape to the heights above the forest, from where he could see the sea, that broad northern ocean, past Perigal, no islands are. A sister of his dead mother lived in the village. She had done what was needful for him as a baby, but she had business of her own. Once he could look after himself at all, she paid no more heed to him. But one day, when the boy was 7 years old, untaught, knowing nothing of the arts and powers that are in the world, he heard his aunt crying out words to a goat which had jumped up onto the thatch of a hut and would not come down. day, herding the long-haired goats in the meadows of Highfall, Dunny shouted to them the words he had heard, not knowing their use or meaning, or what kind of words they are. Noth heareth Malk Man, Kilak Han Mirth Han, he yelled the rhyme aloud. The goats came to him. They came very quickly, all of them together, not making any sound. They looked at him out of their dark slots in their yellow eyes. Dunny laughed and shouted it again, the rhyme that gave him power over the goats. They came closer, crowding and pushing around him. All at once he felt afraid of their thick, rigid horns, their strange eyes and their strange silence. He tried to get free of them and to run away. The ghosts ran with him, keeping in a knot around him. And so they came charging down into the village at last, all the goats going huddled together, as if a rope were pulled tight around them, and the boy in the midst of them, weeping and bellowing. Villagers ran from their houses to swear at the goats and laugh at the boy. Among them came the boy's aunt, who did not laugh. She said a word to the goats, and the beast began to bleat and browse and wander, freed from the spell. Come with me, she said to Dunny. She took him into her hut, where she lived alone. She let no child enter there usually, and the children feared the place. It was low and dusky, windowless, fragrant with herbs that hung drying from the cross pole of the roof, mint and molly and thyme, yarrow and rushwash, and paramal kingsfoil, clovenfoot, tansy, and bay. There his aunt sat cross-legged by the fire pit and looking sidelong at the boy through the tangles of her black hair. She asked him what he had said to the goats and if he knew what the rhyme was. When she found that he knew nothing and yet had spellbound the goats to come with him and follow him, then she saw that he must have had in him the makings of power. As her sister's son, he had been nothing to her, but now she looked at him with a new eye. She praised him and told him that she might teach him the rhymes and he would like better, such as the words that make a snail look out of its shell, or the names that call a falcon down from the sky. Aye, teach me that name, he said, being clear over the fright the goats had given him, and puffed up with praise of his cleverness. The witch had said to him, you will not ever tell that word to the other children if I teach it to you. I promise. She smiled at his ready ignorance. Well and good, but I will bind your promise. Your tongue will be stiffened until you choose to unbind it. And even then, though you can speak, you'll not be able to speak the word I teach you, where another person can hear it. We must keep the secrets of our craft. Good, said the boy, for he had no wish to tell the secret to his playmates. Liking to know and do what they knew not and could not. He sat still while his aunt bound back her uncombed hair, knotted the belt of her dress, and again sat cross-legged, throwing handfuls of leaves into the fire pit, so that a smoke spread and filled the darkness of the hut. She began to sing. Her voice changed, sometimes to a low or high, as if another voice sang through her. The singing went on and on, until the boy did not know if he waked or slept. And all the while, the witch's old black dog that never barked sat by him, with eyes red from the smoke. Then the witch spoke to Dunny, in a tongue he did not understand, and made him say, with her certain rhymes and words, till the enchantment came to him and held him still. Speak, she said, to test the spell. The boy could not speak, but he laughed. And his aunt was a little afraid of his strength, for this was as strong a spell as she knew how to weave. She had tried not only to gain control of his speech and silence, but to bind him at the same time to her service in the craft of sorcery. Yet even as the spell bound him, he had laughed. She said nothing. She threw clear water on the fire till the smoke cleared away and gave the boy water to drink, and when the air was clear and he could speak again, she taught him the true name of the falcon, to which the falcon must come. This was Dunny's first step on the way he was to follow all his life, the way of Majory, the way that led him at last to hunt his shadow over land and sea to lightless coasts of Death's kingdom. But in those first steps along the way, seemed a broad, bright road. When he found that the wild falcon stooped down to him from the wind when he summoned them by name, lightning with a thunder of wings on his wrist like the hunting bird of a prince, then he hungered to know more such names and came to his aunt begging to learn the name of the sparrowhawk and the osprey and the eagle. To earn the words of power, he did all the witch asked him and learned all that she taught, though not all of it was pleasant to do or know. There's a saying on Gaunt, weak as a woman's magic, and there's another saying, wicked as a woman's magic. Now the wind of witch of ten alders was no black sorceress, nor did she even meddle with the high arts or traffic with old powers. But being an ignorant woman among ignorant folk, she often used her crafts to foolish and dubious ends. She knew nothing of the balance and the pattern which the true wizard knows and serves, which keeps him from using his spells unless real need demands. She had a spell for every circumstance and was forever weaving charms. Much of her lore was mere rubbish and humbug, nor did she know the true spells from the false. She knew many curses and was better at causing sickness, perhaps, than at curing it. Like any village witch, she could brew up a love potion. There were other uglier brews she made to serve men's jealousy. Such practices, however, she kept from her young apprentice, and as far as she was able, she taught him honest craft. At first, all his pleasure in the art magic was childlike, the power it gave him over bird and beast, and the knowledge of these. And indeed, that pleasure stayed with him all his life. Seeing him in the high pastures, often with a bird of prey about him, the other children called him Sparrowhawk, and so he came by the name that he kept later in life as his used name when his true name was not known. As the witch kept talking of the glory and the riches, the great power over men that a sorcerer could gain, he set himself to learn more useful lore. He was very quick at it. The witch praised him, and the children of the village began to fear him, and he himself was sure that very soon he would become great among men. So he went on, from word to word, from spell to spell, with the witch, till he was 12 years old, and had learned from her a great deal of what she knew. Not much, but enough for the witch wife of the small village, and more than enough for a boy of 12. She had taught him all her lore in herbals and healing, and all she knew of the crafts of finding, mending, unsealing, and revealing. What she knew of Chancer's tales and the great deed she had sung him, and all the words of the true speech that she had learned from the sorcerer that taught her, she taught again to Dunny. And from weather workers and wandering jugglers who went from town to town with northward veil, in the East Forest, he had learned various tricks and pleasantries, spells of illusion. It was with one of these light spells that he first proved the great power that was in him. In those days, the Kargad Empire was strong. Those are four great lands that lie between the northern and the eastern reaches. Karagaw-At, Atun, Hur-At-Hur, Atini. The tongue they speak there is not like any spoken in the archipelago or of the other reaches. And they are a savage people, white-skinned, yellow-haired, and fierce, like the sight of blood and the smell of burning towns. Last year they attacked Torkils and the strong island of Torhaven, raiding in great force and fleets of red-sailed ships. News of this came north to Gaunt, but the lords of Gaunt were busy with their piracy and paid a little heed to the woes of other lands. Then Spevi fell to the crags and was looted and laid waste, the pupil taken as slaves, so that even now it was an isle of ruins. In lust of conquest, the Karg sailed next to Gaunt, coming in a host, 30 great longships to East Port. They fought through that town, took it, burned it, leaving their ships under guard at the mouth of the river Ar. They went up the vale, wrecking and looting, slaughtering cattle and men. As they went, they spilt into bands, and each of these bands plundered where it chose. Fugitives brought warnings to the village heights. Soon the people of Ten Alder saw smoke darken the eastern sky. And that night, those who climbed the high fall looked down on the vale, all haze and red streaks with fires, where fields ready for harvest had been set ablaze, and orchards burned, roasting on the blazing boughs, and barns and farmhouses smoldered in ruins. Some of the villagers fled up the ravines and hid in the forest, and some made ready to fight for their lives, and some did neither, but stood about lamenting. The witch was one who fled, hiding alone in a cave up on the Capperding Scrape, and sealing the cave mouth with spells. Dunny's father was a bronzesmith, and he was one who stayed, for he would not leave his smelting pit and forge where he had worked for 50 years. All that night he labored, beating up what ready metal he had there into spear points, and others worked with him, binding these to the handles of hoes and rakes, there being no time to make sockets and shaft them properly. There had been no weapons in the village, but hunting bows and short knives, for the mountain folk of Gaunt are not warlike. It is not warriors they are famous for, but goat thieves, sea pirates, and wizards. With sunrise came a thick white fog, on many autumn mornings in the heights of the island. Among their huts and houses down the straggling streets of Ten Alders, the villagers stood waiting, with their hunting bow and new forged spears, not knowing whether the Kargs might be far off or very near. All silent, all peering into the fog that hid shapes and distances and dangers from their eyes. With them was Dunny. He'd worked all night at the forge bellows, pushing and pulling the two long sleeves of goat hide that fed the fire with a blast of air. Now his arm so ached and trembled from the work that he could not hold out the spear he had chosen. He did not see how he could fight or be any good to himself or the villagers. It rackled at his heart that he should die, spitted on a Kargish lance while still a boy. He should go into the dark land without ever having known his own name, his true name as a man. He looked down at the thin arms, wet with cold fog dew, and raged at his weakness, for he knew his strength. There was power in him, if he knew how to use it, and he sought among all the spells he knew for some device that might give him and his companions an advantage, or at least a chance. But need alone is not enough to set powers free. There must be knowledge. The fog was thinning now under the heat of the sun, as shone bare above the peak in a bright sky. As the mist moved and parted in great drifts and smoky wisps, the villagers saw a band of warriors coming up the mountain. They were armored with bronze helmets and greaves and breastplates of heavy leather, shields of wood and bronze, and armed with swords and a long Kargish lance. Winding up along the steep bank of the Ar, they came in plumed, clanking, straggling line, near enough already for their white lances could be seen, and the words of their jargon heard as they shouted to one another. In this band of the invading horde, there were about 100 men, which is not many, but in the village there were only 18 men and boys. Now need called knowledge out. Dunny, seeing the fog below, and thin across the path before the cards, saw a spell that might avail him. An old weather worker of the Vale, seeking to win the boy's apprentice, had taught him several charms. One of these tricks was called fog weaving, a binding spell that gathers the mist together for a while in one place. With it, one skilled in illusion can shape the mist into fair ghostly seemings, which last a little and fade away. The boy had no such skill, but his intent was different, and he had the strength to turn the spell to his own ends. Rapidly and aloud, he named the places and the boundaries of the village, and then spoke the fog-weaving charm. But in among its words, he enlaced the words of the spell of concealment, and last he cried the words that set the magic going. Even as he did so, his father came up behind him, struck him hard on the side of the head, knocking him right down. "Be still, fool. Keep your blathering mouth shut, and hide if you can't." Johnny got to his feet. He could hear the cards now at the end of the village, as near as the great yew tree by the tanner's yard. Their voices were clear, and the clink and creak of their harnesses and arms, they could not be seen. The fog had closed and thickened over the village, graying the light, blurring the world till man could hardly see his own hands before him. "I've hidden us all," Dunny said, sullenly, for his head hurt from his father's blow, and the working of the double incantation had drained his strength. "I'll keep up this fog as long as I can, get the others to lead them up the high fall." The smith stared at his son. He stood wraith-like in that weird, dank mist. It took him a minute to see Dunny's meaning, but when he did, he ran at once, noiselessly, knowing every fence and corner of the village, to find the others and tell them what to do. Now through the gray fog bloomed a blur of red, and the carg set fire to the thatch of a house. Still they did not come up into the village, but waited at the lower end till the mist should lift and lay bare at their loot and prey. The tanner, whose house it was they had burned, set a couple of boys skipping right under the carg's noses, taunting and yelling, and vanishing again like smoke into smoke. Meantime, the older men, creeping behind fences and running from house to house, came close on the other side and sent a volley of arrows and spears at the warriors, who stood all in a bunch. One carg fell writhing from a spear, still warm with its forging, right through his body. Others were arrow-bitten and all enraged. They charged forward then to hew down their puny attackers, but they found only the fog about them, full of voices. They followed the voices, stabbing ahead into the mist with their great plumed, blood-stained lances. Up the length of the street they came, shouting, and never knew they had run right into the village, as the empty huts and houses loomed and disappeared again in the withering gray fog. The villagers ran scattering, most of them keeping well ahead, since they knew the ground. But some, boys or old men, were slow. The carg stumbled on them, drove their lances or hacked with their swords, yelling their war cry. Names of the white god brothers of Atun. "Wula! Atwa!" Some of the band stopped, and they felt the land grow rough underfoot. But others pressed right on, seeking the phantom village, following dim, wavering shapes that fled just out of reach of them. All the mist had come alive with these fleeting forms, dodging, flickering, fading on every side. One group of the cargs chased the wraith straight off the high fall, the cliff's edge above the springs of Ar, and the shapes they pursued ran out onto the air, and there vanished into a thinning of the mist, while the pursuers fell screaming through fog and sudden sunlight, 100 feet sheer to the shallow pools among the rocks. And those that came behind and did not fall stood at the cliff's edge listening. Now dread came into the Karg's hearts. They began to seek one another, not the villagers, in the uncanny mist. They gathered on the hillside, You know, always there were wraiths and ghost shapes among them, and other shapes that ran and stabbed from behind with spear or knife and vanished again. The Kargs began to run, all of them, downhill, stumbling, silent. So all at once they ran out in the gray blind mist and saw the river and the ravines below, and the village all bare and bright in morning sunlight. Then they stopped, gathering together, and looked back. A wall of wavering, withering gray lay blank across their path, hiding all that lay before it. Out from it burst two or three stragglers, lunging and stumbling along, their long lances rocking on their shoulders. Not one Karg looked back more than that once. All went down in haste away from the enchanted place. Farther down the northward vale, those warriors got their fill of fighting. The towns of the East Forest, from Orvark to the coast, had gathered their men and sent them again against the invaders of Gaunt. Band after band came from the hills, and that day and the next, the Kargs were harried back down to the beaches above Eastport, where they found their ships burnt. So they fought with their backs to the sea, till every man of them was killed, and the sands of Armouth were brown with blood till the tide came in. But on that morning in Ten Alder, and up on the high fall, the dank gray fog had clung a while, and then suddenly it blew and drifted and melted away. This man and that stood up in the windy brightness of the morning, looked about him wondering. Here lay a dead Karg with yellow hair, long, loose, and bloody. And there lay the village, Tanner, killed in battle like a king. Down in the village, the house that had been set afire still blazed. They ran to put out the fire, since their battle had been won. But in the street, near the great yew, they found Dunny, the bronzesmith's son, standing by himself, bearing no hurt, but speechless and stupid like one stunned. They were well aware of what he had done, and they led him into his father's house and went calling for the witch to come down out of her cave and heal the lad who had saved their lives and their property, all but four who were killed by the Krags in the one house that was burnt. Is an excerpt, the beginning of Wizard of Earthsea. Please, back in the 60s, first published in 1968 by Ursula K. Le Guin. What I really love about stories like this, and, you know, in a lot of ways, this is perfect material for the entire theme of this show. It's a example of what we call modern myth-making. There's a lot of reminiscence to older fairy tales, fantasy stories that we've heard, you know, magic and spells and wizards and witches. But, you know, these are not dead stories. They don't belong to, you know, people who lived thousands of years ago or hundreds of years ago in a time that was magical and now, you know, is no longer. It's still alive. We still have it with us. And great people, great writers, myth makers to this day are taking up these stories and refashioning them for new generations all the time. Kevin, Dan, how did you guys like the story?
A couple things I wanted to mention. One of them is the idea of the power of words. In the beginning, they were talking about magic words. Can you hear me okay over there?
Yes.
Okay. They're talking about the power of words, and that reminds me of the entire idea in a book that I have that a friend of mine recommended to me called The Hero's Journey, I believe it's called. It's a book about writing and making stories and structuring them. And I like when they mention in the book, Vogler is the guy's name. A lot of college students who are into writing might be familiar with that name. But he mentions the power of words, because early on in your story you were talking about these magic words, incantations that would bring, you know, communicate with the hawk and the falcon and the goats. And it makes me think of when you spell a word, it's you cast a spell, right? So you spell something, so you're casting a spell. So the power of words, it's always been a tradition of incantations. And in truth, in what you might call real magical practice or real metaphysical practice, it's not really the words itself that's magic. I think it's more the fact that you're chanting it over and over again that really makes it, or that you believe in it or can put emotion into it. Some people will look for, what's the best chant for this? Is this chant really charged, or is it just the fact that you have so much emotion thrown into the chant or into the mantra or into the words or the sentence or phrase that makes it effective and magical and powerful?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, this isn't a closed case here. I mean, everyone's, you know, got different theories on this and how it works, and, you know, magical theory is something that, you know, no one will ever get through all the material, all the theories, all the opinions.
No, I just closed it. No, I'm just kidding.
No. The case is closed, folks. Dan's got the answer.
Forget
for
it.
Us.
Good night. Thanks, everybody, for joining us.
It's interesting in the Earthsea series, you know, she does a very good job of clearly defining how her magic system works and, like, what the basis of it is. And it could almost be called, you know, something like name magic, where they're actually, you know, it's not just about, like, it's not just the intention or anything like that, but everything has, all things have a true name.
Mm-hmm.
And the power of magic, you could say, lies in knowing the names. And, you know, so they're not just arbitrary. It's not necessarily just about repetition or creating, you know, that certain mind state. But it's about knowing the names of everything, knowing the name of the falcon, of the sparrowhawk, of, you know, knowing what name to call the goats by.
And I do understand that. Since you're talking about names, I also thought it was interesting. Here are three things I thought were interesting about that. Because the other day I was reading the book that I mentioned that talked about, you know, to spell, like to cast a spell, to spell a word, the power of the word. And also they kept mentioning they called the guy Sparrowhawk. And of course, my pagan name is Sparrow. That was like a name I got in a meditation. And also, or sort of a shaman name, you know what I mean? A pagan name or a shaman name. And I also thought it was funny that the writer was Ursula. And yesterday I read a story about Ursula Goats, so it was kind of funny to have two Ursulas in here back to back. Not a real common name to have. And it was the story of the Witch of the Smithy in 1623, I believe, in Marktal, Baroque Germany, and a story of a witch that was sentenced to death. So, and her name was Ursula. And another character in that book was named Ursula, so there's been three Ursulas in this studio in 2 days, including your author.
It's definitely a name that has a magical ring to it. But yes, for all my listeners out there, Ursula K. Le Guin is someone I would very much recommend without hesitation. She is, if anything, probably more well known for her science fiction writing. Practiced Taoism for most of her life, has her own translation of the Tao Te Ching. And it really comes through in many of her writings and stories. Many, many short stories. Really just a fantastic writer. And so Yeah, that was an excerpt from the beginning of the Earthsea series. And in fact, the next story I'm going to read by Gene Wolfe. Gene Wolfe and Ursula K. Le Guin are actually, from what I understand, very good friends. And from what I've read, praise each other's works very, very highly. Have incredible respect for each other. You know. So we'll get into that now, and we'll see. You know, there's a certain... They're contemporaries. Another example of modern myth-making here, of some modern fantasy. Recasted stories that we've all heard before. And this is a story called Bag. Once upon a time, there was a boy named Eric who had a tame raven and a ragged cap and no boots and lived with his mother in a cottage in the forest. Eric and his mother were very poor, but nonetheless they possessed a great treasure, a charm ancient and powerful. This was a bear's skull and hung from the roof beams of their little house on a chain of iron. Eric's great-grandfather had made it long ago, choking the bear with moonlight and filling his skull with the cottony tails of rabbits and the urine of shadows and the black feathers snatched at great risk from the left foreleg of an eagle and many other things. The bear's skull was the home of Thag, as a beehive is the home of bees, and Thag was a powerful spirit, though he was often away. One day, when Eric and his mother were picking mushrooms in the damp spring woods, he asked her to tell him, again, about the last time Thag had returned home. For this had been the winter after Eric was born, and he had been too small to remember. So Eric's mother told him, and it was a story that grew better with each telling. Just as the hilt of a skarmisax learns to glow beneath its owner's hands. For Eric's father had, with the aid of Thag, made the trees to dance down the hill road and built a great hall of glass on Nine Men's Meadow, through whose dome the stars could be seen by daylight, and forced certain rich men in the town to disgorge a part of what they had won by law from the poor country folk, and for the last, after Thag had gone again, had been hanged. There had been a great fair on the gallows hill, as Eric's mother explained to him, for the hanging, with jugglers and gingerbread and beer given free so that men filled their caps with it and set them on their heads. She and Eric had been the cynosure of all eyes, the only time in her life that she had felt so important, so that she swore if she could, she would marry tomorrow, if only her new husband could be hanged too. And it was then that Eric decided that if ever Thag came home to the bear's skull again, he would use him and surpass all the exploits of his father, both for wonder and boldness. Now that night, Thag returned. Eric was sleeping in his little three-sided loft beneath the roof when he dreamed he saw a running man in crimson and gold who carried a naked falchion. Eric knew it was the custom of Thag to appear as a man in dreams and otherwise in reality. And he knew that this was Thag. Behind Thag, very dimly seen, and small in the distance, were three figures, but Eric paid them little attention. He woke, and the whole house was quiet as the wind in the wood. Then Nip the Raven stirred on his perch and said, "Mystery." And Eric heard a humming in the bear's skull outside his window and knew Thag was back. In the morning, it would be necessary to propitiate Thag, and then he could do whatever he wanted. Now the king of that country was named Charles the Wise, and he was sleeping late of the morning following the day following the night Thag had returned at last. When he was waked all at once by three things together. The first was that the queen ran into his bedroom screaming. The second was a great shouting in the bailey, accompanied by the clashing and smashing heard when pole arms and partisans and halberds and brown bills are let fall to the cobbles. And the third was that the whole castle had begun to rock back and forth beneath him. So when he looked out the windows, he saw the great watchtower tossing against the sky like the mainmast of a galleys in a gale. Then the queen, a tall, fair, fine-featured woman, just settling into solid flesh after her girlhood, with no more brains in a sack of groats, cried, "Charles, save me!" And when he asked her what was wrong, she explained that they were set upon by the murdered powers of hell, and every knight in the castle who could throw a leg over a horse was already 10 days ride off, and the men-at-arms had dropped them and were hiding in the cistern, and the archers were all unstrung as well. And she concluded by saying that if he did not flee this minute, they were doomed. Then the king took thought, and particularly upon his father's maxim, given him when he was but young, that kings had three-legged stools, the first leg being their armies, and their castles, and their treasuries. Then it came to him that as his army was scattered, if he should leave his castle, and the gold and silver therein, he should have nothing, and would be a king no longer. And also that the tax rolls of the kingdom were long and complex, and the winding of the castle passages of great elaboration, and that the conquerors, whoever they were, might welcome someone who could explain these things, and that in time they might even be persuaded to go a-conquering elsewhere and leave the affairs of that kingdom in the hands of that trusty vassal, Charles, who was ready so well suited to direct them. And so he bade the queen drink a flagon of wine and be quiet. He dressed himself in hose and a jerkin, rich and impressive, but without presumption, and went out to confront his conquerors. But he found no one there but Eric. "Well," said the king, "how do you do, boy? Where has everyone gone?" "I believe most of them have run away," Eric told him, "but a good many have been eaten." Then the raven, Nip, came and settled on his shoulder. The king dropped to his knees at once. "I perceive you are a magician," said the king, "and that bird is your puissant familiar. And I confess, it has always seemed to me that were I a magician, I would choose to return to that very age at which you manifest yourself. But I would think you must find the raiment you have selected rather chill. I can show you better." In this way, Eric became ruler of the country. And after giving his mother a kingdom of her own, and then shutting her in a bottle because she would not stay there, reigned without aging at all for 30 years. At the end of which time, the realm was a wilderness. Deer ran through the streets and towns, and few there were to loose an arrow. Wolves bred in the wineries, and foxes in fawning pens. Undines from the sea came up the river 10 leagues beyond the ford. The stone trolls of the mountains were seen on the roads at noon, and goblins, excessively ugly and evil, with 17 fingers on each hand and steel teeth, stood guard at the castle Barbican. Throughout all this, Eric was, needless to say, exceedingly happy. As for Thag, he had taken the dungeon for his own, but came out promptly whenever he was wanted, and occasionally when he was not. He took the form of a black and reeking mist, a crab covered with living slime, a dog with its fur afire, a fountain of sand, and many other things. And when Eric rode out hunting on a unicorn or a hippogriff, as often as not, he sometimes noticed that the castle was coming to resemble the skull of the bear, but it did not disturb him at all. King Charles, who had often assured Eric that his name was the Foolish, stayed on with his queen, they having become Eric's principal servitors, Thag accepted, and rejoiced in the possession of a son called Prince Robert, who was the rightful heir, though he scarcely knew it. And while the king often mourned in secret for the palmy days of his pride, he comforted himself with the knowledge that he was still in command of his castle and treasure. Eric had hardly spent a cent. Thus matters stood until one evening, when Eric was dining in the great hall by the light of a single guttering candle on a golden bricket. There appeared from nowhere three remarkable figures. The first was a blonde girl of great beauty, who wore a diaphanous gown and left one breast bare. The second was a dark-haired woman, also of great beauty, with white forelock that made Eric think of a night sky slashed by lightning. This woman was dressed in a white robe embroidered with gold and carried a staff forked at the top like the horns of a bull. The third was a man, tall and muscular, gray-bearded and one-eyed. And as this man, the last of the three, appeared, there came from the dungeons a roar of anguish. Eric saw at once that these were not common folk, for he would have had them devoured, and rose and introduced himself and offered to share his dinner with the newcomers. But he had no sooner done this than his pet, ravens or long-lived birds, sometimes inconveniently so, came flapping in at the window and lit on the one-eyed man's shoulder. "Now," the one-eyed man said, "I see we're in some kind of castle." And he began to examine the hangings and decorations, as if he were leaving everything to the woman with the staff. "I heard Thag roar," she said. "At the moment, we materialized. How long has he been here?" 30 years, said Eric, so surprised that he never considered not answering. "Time flies rapidly here, then," the one-eyed man continued. He had taken down a broad spear from the wall and was fingering the edge as he spoke. "I thought we were close upon Thag." "We were," the woman told him. "But as you say, time can pass quickly here. 30 years between paragraph and paragraph, if need be." "What do you mean?" asked the man. But before she could answer him, the king and queen entered, followed by Prince Robert. They had been watching from an alcove, and the king, who was of the old belief, as the mighty usually are, whether or not they'll admit it, had decided to throw his sword. "Great Woden," he said, "we cast ourselves upon your mercy, and on the mercy of serene Frigg and lovely Freya. The throne of this land is mine to hold in my lifetime, mine to give by father right, to my son when I die. For half again a score of years I have been defrauded of it. Slay the monster and grant me justice. And Woden said, "What the hell is he talking about?" And as he spoke, the keystone of the great arch of the castle cracked. A little sliver of stone, no bigger than a fingernail, fell ringing to the floor. "He thinks we're the Norse gods," the woman said, and the girl added, "Don't you see, Daddy? We're in a book." "That's impossible." "Not more impossible than going backward in time. Look around at things. There's the evil magician, that boy in the pointed hat. Here's the castle. There's the true king. The fat lady is the queen. And that fellow who hangs his head and snivels is the prince. Bag is the monster in a crypt beneath the castle. We will kill him and disappear. The magician gets pushed off a roof or something. And that's the end." Eric asked, "Are you saying that we are people in a book in whatever place you come from?" The one-eyed man nodded. "That's what we're saying. A fairy tale. I'm not sure I believe it." He paused. "Are you well-read, at least by whatever standards are used here?" Eric nodded. "I've spent many happy hours in the castle library. It's something we enchanters are expected to do, and I've come to enjoy it." "Then tell me something. Do the characters in the books you have read ever read themselves?" Eric shook his head. "Never, to my knowledge. They're always going somewhere." "That might be it then. In our world, you see, it would be quite possible for a character in a book to sit peacefully before his fire reading short stories of Alexander Schollenstein." Just at that instant, Thag rushed into the room in the form of a headless bear, blood spurting from the stump of his neck. "Do I kill him?" Woden asked Frigg. "A moment ago, I would have said yes." The bear stood upright before the one-eyed man, blood cascading over his shoulders and his extended paws. "Now you don't? Why not?" Freya Goldenhair touched his arm. "It will be the end of the story, won't it, Daddy? If we can't be killed, how can Thag? He's been here 30 years now, they say. Won't this just turn him loose to go somewhere else? I don't think this is where he really belongs," the woman called Frigg said. "This is probably a very low energy level for him, as it is for us. He's asking you to do it. Standing there with his chest exposed like that. If he's not begging you not to, I don't like it." Then the thing to do here is to keep him here. Like a fisherman impaling a pike, Woden drove his spear into the bear's hind foot, pinning it to the oak floor of the hall. "Make it tight," the woman called Frigg advised him. And with a spiky Morgenstern, he pounded the iron-shod staff until the head was nearly buried in the wood. "Use him for your spells all you want," the one-eyed man told Eric. "But if you let him go now, I think he'll disappear on you. I know damned well I'll come back here and make you sorry you did." Eric bowed. "I understand, Magister," Frigg whispered to Freya. "There has to be a world that corresponds to each of our fictions, dear. Since what never was, nor will be, is inconceivable. Still, I wonder what Thag really is." And the bear became a snake, pinned by the tail, and struck an inch short of her heel. "Magister," Eric asked as the one-eyed man began to melt into the air. "What shall I call you? You said you are not Woden." "My name is Harry Naylor." Eric bowed again. "Harry Naylor, it is fitting, Magister," He was already thinking of the things he would do to the king. And as soon as the three were gone, he did them and lived, in the most literal sense of the words, happily ever after. That is a very fun story to read. You know, so many things I like about it. I don't really, you know, what in particular can we talk about it or can we say about it?
I like the idea
of the self-awareness that they're all just sort of playing a part in a story, and the idea that they're in a book, and that they go, wait a minute, I think we're in a book. I actually had a story idea like that, similar myself one time, of a man who nothing goes right for him, and it turns out because something terrible happened or some goofy, just quirky accident happened, and he was a character accidentally in the wrong book. So there was no destiny written for him, so nothing worked out. Not that he was bad, not that awful things were happening to him. It just seemed like nothing was there for him. Like, it was this guy, and I even picture the idea of he's, like, attractive and talented and can do all these things, but there's no destiny, not even possible destinies laid out, except for the one that he was written in the wrong book. But anyway, that was just a story idea I had. But I like that idea of a character thinking, am I just part of a story? So that's one thing I took from that story.
Yeah, I agree. That's definitely the crux of it. I also really like, in the end, this this section where Frigg whispers to Freya, or as they're called by the king anyway, although that's not really who they are. There has to be a world that corresponds to each of our fictions, dear, since what never was nor will be is inconceivable. Still, I wonder what Thrag really is. You know, this is a classic idea in fantasy. You know, I suppose one that could be used to validate it. You know, I know there's people out there who don't give any credit to fiction or fantasy like that and think it's, you know, worthless, and if there's, you know, trying to come up with a defense for why fantasy is important, you know, you could, I suppose, throw that out there. Not that it really needs any defending in the first place. But the idea itself is very interesting. That it never was and never will be, that it's inconceivable and it would have never been thought of. And so, you know, how these stories and, you know, texts and mythologies just come alive when we read them. You know, they've been thought up in someone's head, put down on paper, you know, with a pen and ink, or in a typewriter or word processor. And, you know, then they're sent out into the world, and we all have the great joy and blessing to share them and to enter these worlds that were conceived in, you know, from another mind. You know, for me, that's in a lot of ways the essence of magic right there. You know, and the magic that we tell in the tales is just an auxiliary magic for the magic that we can share the world that we create with one another. It's so simple and unsuspecting a way is, you know, writing our stories and sharing them.
I wanted to add the idea that when you said the importance, which is a lot about what your show is about, Zariana Radio, is the importance of myth and the function of it in your daily lives. One thing that I was having a conversation with Kevin about was his technique
for communicating with a spirit guide or his personal spirit guide. And we were talking about that at Sticks and Stones the other day. And that's the idea of you think of a character that you relate to and you sort of put a lot of energy to it and start talking, communicating with him. If I'm saying this right, I might have Kevin explain it better.
Yeah.
You breathe your creativity and intuition and all that into this being, like, say, in his case, he thinks his spirit guide looks a lot like Mila Jovovich from The Fifth Element, that girl, right? And so you think,
good
okay,
movie.
Yeah, well, it's a great movie. I love that movie. And you think in that spirit guide, it's like you're creating this energy vehicle, if I say it right, from which to communicate with spirit. And it
right.
becomes real. It's not that it isn't real, and it's not actually Mila Jovovich, for example, but you've put this personality, created it, and I'll let Kevin explain it a little bit too.
Yeah, Kevin's been with us very patiently this whole time. We're getting towards the end of our show. I want to give Kevin the floor. We've read these stories.
With what Daniel's talking about, activating or hiring a spirit guide as an actor, actress, best friend from when you were a little kid, that you bring together your personification or personification of your creativity and your intuition to help you come up with things and solutions that help you live your life. Once you come up with something significant as a solution that helps you and other people, you can give that credit, if you want to, as an exercise to that spirit guide to say thank you. But you're really thanking yourself, but directing it to the source of likely where you came from. And I look at it as the dreamscape, and the place that we go to when we dream is eternal. So this source that you're getting your information from is an eternal source for solutions and answers.
You know, and that's so similar, and my thoughts exactly with my Zara mythos, Zarayana.
Right.
You know, she is a goddess that came to me, you know, in a time when I needed her most. And, you know, showed me a way to live my life by writing stories about her. And through the stories, you know, I essentially was able to tell myself what I needed to know when, you know, there's not just a knowing it and then, like, an accepting it. It's like I almost had to, like, you know, reflect it off of, you know, this mirror, you know, that's somewhere within myself, you know, which is Zara or whatever your spirit guide is. And you can reflect it back to yourself and look at what you've created. And, you
as
know,
it falls into that principle that as within, so without. You're kind of a conduit almost. She exists as part of you.
Yeah, and, you know, for me, it's, you know, I don't want to, you know, I call her a goddess, and she is. But what I mean by that, and, you know, what I mean by, you know, I telling myself these things and, like, I created this. For me, this is the divinity that dwells within all human beings and within all creatures. You know, so that source that it comes from isn't the Evan Posse's, you know, speaking right now. Over Blog Talk Radio that you're all listening to. This comes from you know, the indwelling source, something so, you know, far below and so far above my surface level, you know, that, you know, try to point it out or identify it. You know, I'm not saying it's me, and I don't think that's what, you know, what we're saying, that, like, we, like, create our spirit guides. But it does come from within. And, you know, what are these spirit guides but a mask or a costume to put over the divine so that we can communicate with them? So that, you know, we have an interface, something that we're capable of comprehending, something that, you know, we can communicate with on our level and, you know, bring us into this world. Because so often, you know, there's disassociation and dissonance with the world around us. And, you know, mythology has always been that medium for bringing us back into the world, for saying, this is my interface with reality. This explains the universe that we are a part of. and explains my role in it and why we're here and why we do what we do. And this is, you know, it's not, I don't think, enough just to accept that it's out there, you know. Or I don't want to speak for all people. I hate doing that. I can only speak for myself. For me personally, it's not enough to accept the images, the masks for the divine that have been created by others. I learn by them. I study them. I'm fascinated by them. And, you know, I interface, you know, with the many forms of the divine, the many names, and the many faces. But through all that, all it does is create within me a yearning to, you know, form my own image, to develop my own interface. It speaks completely to me because no other interface, you know,
perfectly registers.
There's, you know, there's always something, a desire for it to be completely unique, completely from the heart, something personal.
And I think at some point in history, that's what has always happened. Somebody created a great interface. I was going to use the word interface, so I'm glad you used that.
Well, it's, you know, it's a technological word and a word, you know, a metaphor that applies with computers and the technological age we live in.
Yeah.
And Zara is very much a goddess of the technological age. So, you know, some people might find it a little bit offensive just because it seems like, you know, maybe it might seem like that's like a little degrading of a way to put it. But for me, I think it's the opposite. Like, this is a technological age. We understand things through interfaces. Every one of us out there is on our cell phone, on our computers, looking at televisions all the time. This is an audio interface right now that you're listening to. Mm-hmm. You know, everywhere around us is interface. You know, that's just like, it's simply the metaphor that we have right now and how we communicate with each other, with the world, how we get our information, how we get our entertainment. It's all interfacing. And we didn't have that word before, but you know, now we do, and I think it's, you know, perfectly suitable term. So it's one that I've definitely adopted.
And that's a good example of, you can have something that's a word that didn't exist, just like your pantheon at one time didn't exist. The qualities of it did, but not actually Zara or Zariana. But now it does, and now it's powerful to you, just like now the word interface is very meaningful, or whatever the new modern terms are, internet, right? There used to be the word internet.
Right.
Now they're powerful. And I just want to get to our plugs real quick.
Absolutely.
I wanted to shout out to Kevin Baird, the creator of the Horizon Oracle deck. He's also a member of Artisans United and creator of Paranormal Windows and Gaia Gardens, two artistic projects, of which Kevin gave me one of the Paranormal Windows today, so that was very, very awesome. We'll hang that up on the wall somewhere here. I thought it looked pretty good right over there in the studio.
Yep.
As well as getting to Esoterica online, www.esotericanova.com. So with your New Age Interfaith Focus, herbs, crystals, stones, oils, candles, incense, divination tools, and more. And then, of course, Main Street Universe is now a network with three shows. We have the Wednesday flagship show, 11 a.m., Main Street Universe, with our new guest host, Nick Barry. Zariana Radio, which you're listening to right now, with host Evan Pass. And, of course, Walking on the Sidewalk from 6 to 7 now with Kevin Baird, creator of the Horizon Oracle. And, Evan?
I also just want to add one thing just real quick, is that we have an upcoming show that's going to be in Russian, it's going to be about the wisdom... Yeah, Olga is going to be hosting it, and it's going to be about the wisdom of Demir. He wrote a bunch of music with, you know, lyrics and musics and that kind of stuff to really convey his feeling about spirit and life and everything. So that'll probably be on Mondays.
Okay.
All right, very good. So we're winding down here to the end of our show. We've got 5 minutes left. Do we have any other thoughts on these stories that we read? Kevin?
Yeah. The thing is that we have to remember, where were all these stories before the word was invented, when we only had grunts and oinks and groans and coughs and that kind of stuff?
Hitting on drums.
Hitting on, yeah,
rocks.
Drums and logs and everything. And I think it's the birds that taught us to speak and the frogs that taught us to speak. And your story about the sparrowhawk person is really dialing back to that age before the spoken word was able to be captured onto the walls or the rocks or the stone or marble or something like that. And really what he, I feel, is trying to connect to was the energy of inspiration, divine inspiration, that moved people to capture something that was so inspiring that they felt like they should share it with the rest of the world, hence the written word on the page. And then that taught others how to write their thoughts on the page, and so on and so on and so on. So by looking at lore and mythology and spending time there, we get to spend time in the thoughts and the intuition and the creativity of the individual that was capturing that experience onto page. And by us sort of like reading that, we in a sense do a mind meld, or we link with their consciousness and the I guess the flavor of their connection to the divine. And by us just taking a moment or two to read and connect, we're able to sort of like step away from the places that we might feel like we're bogged down in, to just leave that alone for a little bit, let it evolve a little bit, go drop into that mythology a little bit, and we could probably come up upon something that would be very helpful for us to solve this thing that we had to step away from because we felt like we're a barrier or up against a wall or something. By connecting to that mythology and reading it, in a sense, is the same thing as connecting with your spirit guide, that is a binding of your intuition and your creativity. So the mythology is very important. It helps people step away from the things that they feel like they're locked up in, so they can sort of like just rest a minute, like taking a nap or something, and, you know, returning.
And like, for instance, what you're talking about and how important it is to people, just like the theme of this, of Evan's show here, still tons of people watch movies. So there's a need for stories. Even in the recession, the movie theater was bogged down, packed. But go ahead, Evan.
Well, Kevin, beautiful thoughts. And, you know, that's, for me, that's the power of storytelling, you know. And, yes, that human word, our language, evolved, you know, perhaps how many thousands of years of sitting around fires in circles, you know, with that language evolving slowly, beating drums, playing animal bone flutes. You know, every day, every night, evolving a little bit further, the story becoming a little bit more complex, the language needing to evolve a little bit further in order to capture what it is that we really feel. And even today, I don't think there's one among us who feels like we can express what it is that we feel with our words. Language is always grasping for the ineffable, and ultimately we'll never grasp it. But, you know, as we progress, as we move on, we always feel like we're getting a little bit closer. The story grows a little bit more complex. Our language gains more capacity. And, you know, the tale continues over and over and over again. Thank you for being here, Kevin. It's been a pleasure. Drop by anytime. I hope you will.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you. And Daniel, a great show. Till next time, all you beautiful listeners. Blessings, blessings, blessings.